MSW Media.
Prevail, c'est щотижнева програма про політику.
L'histoire, la sécurité nationale.
Crimen organizado, dinero sucio.
Глобальну корупцію та боротьбу за демократію.
Y ahora,
a teper.
Et maintenant,
con ustedes, su anfitrión,
Gregoria.
Welcome back to the fight. This time I know our side will win.
I'm Greg Oliar. This is Prevail. Welcome to the program. We've got a great show. Alisa Albert is here. Alisa is a novelist, a writer of short stories and essays, and has taught creative writing at the College of St. Rose and at Columbia. She's a very accomplished novelist. Her most recent novel, Human Blues, was named by Publishers Weekly one of the top 10 works of fiction published in 2022. Yeah, you know, she's good. She's accomplished and she's funny and smart and, you know, she's a damn good writer. I met Alisa, I think in 2012, I think that's when it was, at the Woodstock Literary Festival where, you know, we both had books out. That was really cool, by the way, Woodstock Literary Festival. And as much as I enjoy talking to novelists about novel writing and literature and all that fun stuff, I wanted to have Alisa on today because she wrote a piece, a very short piece in Tablet Mag called An Open Letter to Hamas's Defenders. The first three lines are, "Hi, terror apologist." So that gives you some idea of the tenor of the piece. I want to read just one of the paragraphs here. Okay, now I'm quoting. "We weep for the plight of the Palestinian people and for the ignorance and naivete of so many who believe that anyone but Hamas is responsible for their current suffering. Someday, when this war we didn't want is over, I'd love to discuss the radicalization of the oppressed and the fomenting of extremism and Israeli intellectuals who have been warning against this very scenario for decades. When this war we did not want is over, we can grab coffee and talk about Iran and Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Jordan and Egypt and Yemen. We can talk about building terror infrastructure under a hospital, about the concept of quote-unquote martyrdom and propaganda. We can talk about squandered opportunities. We can talk about Hamas's misdirected slash stolen billions in aid. We can talk about means and ends and which ends justify which means." So I read this piece. And, you know, I've been reading a lot of stuff about the war, trying to understand it, and this helped me understand it. So I really wanted to have her on to talk about, you know, kind of the impetus for writing this. And I learned two things. First of all, her stepfather was an active member of Kibbutz Be'eri from 1969 to 1980. And that's one of the kibbutzes where the slaughters happen on October 7th by Hamas. The other thing I didn't know is that Alisa was in Israel when this happened. She and her mother were there, you know, visiting. They hadn't been there in a while, and they were, I'll let her explain it on the interview, but she was there when the attacks happened on the 7th. So, you know, she wasn't in the South, but she was still in Israel. Israel's not a very big country. So she has a better idea than most Americans what went on that day. And I think it's really important to hear what she has to say. So I'm really grateful to her for coming on the podcast and talking about this. I think that it's a difficult subject to talk about for a lot of reasons, not least because every time you talk about it, you're afraid, you know, to say the wrong thing. I think a lot of people feel that way. But it's important to talk about. We have to keep talking about it. There's too much at stake here. And we just need to keep talking about it. We need to understand better what's happening. And we need to be able to curb and combat all of the anti-Semitism going on in the country and the world right now. I mean, it's really not great. It's embarrassing, frankly, to be an American and see all this stuff happening. So I think that talking about this is really, really important. And yeah, I wanted to give her time on the podcast to talk. So there's not going to be any ads on this program today. We're just going to go right through the interview. So I don't know. I just felt like I didn't want to disturb the flow of the interview with some, you know, commercial break. Not that we don't love our sponsors, because we do. Shout out HelloFresh. Just a couple quick announcements. This is going to be the last show for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, I guess. I'm taking the next two Fridays off, which is the 17th and then I guess the 24th. The Prevail podcast will be back in December on the 1st of December, the Friday, December 1. That's a time period that encompasses Veterans Day, which is really Armistice Day. You know, the end of the First World War, the 11th minute of the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. That's when World War I ended. I'm reading a really good book about the start of that war now called The Guns of August. And it's a mind blow. Gosh, so well written. But I have that on my mind a lot, and how little things, little tiny misunderstandings and petty grievances and the wrong people being in positions of power can totally screw up world affairs in a major, major way. And, you know, when Jason Pack was on, he was arguing that this is a new period of history. But there's other people that argue that it's similar to the startup to the First World War, in that it's a multipolar world where, you know, there is no one hegemonic force. And therefore, the other powers are jockeying for position. Germany, France, England, Russia, to a lesser degree, Austria, jockeying for position and supremacy in Europe, and therefore the world, in 1914. And I hope that we're not headed on that same direction. I really hope that we're not. The other day, of course, is Thanksgiving, which is my favorite holiday of the year. So I'm not going to be on here again until after Thanksgiving. I want to wish all of you listeners a happy Thanksgiving. Please know that I'm grateful for you for listening. I'm grateful for your support. I'm grateful to everybody who subscribes to the Prevail Substack, which is how I keep the lights on, as they say. That's $6 a month, $55 for the year. I appreciate everybody that's done that. I appreciate everybody that reads and shares and listens to the work here. And I hope that, you know, wherever you are, you have a great holiday. And even though the world appears to be on fire right now, that you can find something, many things, to be thankful for. We'll be right back with Elisa Albert. Is online pornography ruining your social life? Can't stop consuming erotic content? Concerned about a loved one looking at X-rated videos? Hi, I'm Speaker of the House Mike Johnson, here to tell you about Second Coming, the new porn substitute app from NoFap Technologies. With Second Coming, you don't have to worry about worshiping graven images, because you won't see any. Here's how it works. Every time the user tries to access porn, the app redirects the browser to more acceptable content, like films about gladiators, the Wikipedia entry for Greco-Roman wrestling, high-res images of Michelangelo's David, or footage of Tim Tebow doing calisthenics. Porn addiction keeping you down? Rise again with Second Coming. Check out our page on OnlyFans. Second Coming, it's a revelation. And now, back to the show. Elisa Albert, welcome to Prevail.
Thanks, Greg.
I really appreciate you taking the time to come on to share your experiences and your thoughts about, you know, the situation in Israel right now after the attacks on the Hamas attacks on October 7th. You wrote this fantastic essay for Tablet called An Open Letter to Hamas's Defenders. The first three words are, "Hi, terror apologist." It's very short, but to the point. And I thought it was just a wonderful piece of writing. And I read this and I was like, I would like her to come on the podcast and talk about this if she would like to and come on. You and I know each other a little bit in literary circles because we met at the Woodstock Writers Festival, whenever that was,
pre-45, as you call him, in the before times.
Good old days.
Yeah. So, you know, you've got now, but I'm also interested in your view as a novelist, because I think that novelists have a way of looking at things that's a little bit different, that takes all of the information and can crunch it in ways that other people maybe can't as easily. So my first question is, and I know now that you were there, you were in Israel in October. So let's start with that. Talk about what that was like for you.
Bizarre, obviously unforeseen. It was supposed to be just a delightful trip. I was with my 80-year-old mom, with whom I first spent time in Israel in 1986 when I was going into second or third grade. And we were going to see the installation of the Codex Sassoon in the Anu Museum in Tel Aviv, the Museum of the Jewish People, the oldest known, most complete Hebrew Bible in existence, that was bought at auction a few months ago, earlier this year, for $36 million and donated to this museum. And it was going to be installed. And so we were going to take part in those ceremonies. And my mom said, come on, let's go. We haven't, you know, it's been a long time. And I just couldn't, you know, I couldn't say no. She said, when are we going to get to do this again? Let's go. It had been some years since I'd spent time in Israel. I've been yearning to be there. Every part of my life I've spent time there, I find it very difficult to leave. It feels like a real home to me. So we were there to have a great time, see friends, see family, have a wonderful celebratory time. It was Sukkot, which is the harvest festival. Delightful, extra delightful time to be there. And about a week into our visit, we woke to rocket fire over Tel Aviv early on the morning of the 7th. Rocket fire is just a part of life in Israel. Israel has the defensive shield to shoot down rockets because it's such a regular part of life. So believe it or not, I went back to sleep that morning. Yeah. Woke up, looked out the window. Oh, shit, rocket fire. All right, well, I don't hear sirens. I'm going back to sleep. Slept for an hour or so, really got up, and then it began to dawn on all of us what was going on. And then spent the next few days in and out of bomb shelters, wandering around Tel Aviv, kind of against the advice of most people.
Everyone, yeah. Yeah.
But I, the expression, I wouldn't die on that hill.
Yeah.
I would very much die on that hill, is my feeling. So everybody kept saying, oh, I'm so sorry you're there. I'm like, I'm not, you know, this is very real and it's very horrible, but I was grateful to be there, and it felt meaningful. And I don't know. I think I have work to do now, you know, having been there. I think for a reason is a strange thing to say, but I'm not sorry I was there. I'm glad I got home, quote unquote, home. Yeah. It feels strange to call this my home because I feel very much like that's my home. But here we are. So
yeah. I do understand. I think that feeling of, you know, that you want to be there. Like, I mean, I was in New York City at 9/11, which is what the attack everyone's comparing it to. I wasn't anywhere near the buildings, but I was still there. And I'm, you know, especially every year that goes by, I'm more grateful that I was there.
Yeah.
Because, you know, as I move farther away from the city, fewer and fewer people that I know were. So I get that, the idea of being a witness and, you know, telling everybody what happened. So, I think that it's really important to talk about this. I think it's hard to talk about, especially, you know, for Americans, certainly. Yeah. That's what we're seeing now. And I think and it's hard to know how to think about it and how to approach thinking about it. So mm-hmm. I've been, you know, since this happened, I've really been reading a lot and trying to interviewing people and trying to get as much information as I can, you know, to get a handle on the situation. But, you know, the first thing I want to say,
if you ever get a handle on the situation, let everyone know, because we've been trying for quite a while.
Well, at least to understand as best I can the intricacies of, you know, sort of what's going on and the sides and who's you know, what the grievances are and all that, yeah, and all that kind of stuff. So, and your piece really helped crystallize it for me, which is, you know, thank you for that.
I'm so glad, and you're welcome. And, you know, it's funny maybe because, I found myself in dialogue with people on Instagram, which is my social media drug of choice. And I felt, you know, it's my husband saying, get off Instagram. It's, you know, you're in a lot of pain. It's hurting you. It's like, you know what? I can't be on the front lines. I can't even be there right now, but I can be here and I can stand up and use my tools, which are words, in this way. So I was engaging. And that piece actually came out of, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning, unable to sleep, haunted by images and horrors and responding to some ostensibly well-meaning rando acquaintance, yeah, on Instagram saying, I really think the only way forward is for everyone to have empathy for each other, and just some kind of mealy, you know, that's a lovely idea. Thank you so much, random person who has no fucking idea. Can I say fucking on this?
Absolutely. Podcast? Fuck yeah.
Who has no fucking idea what you're talking about. Like, that's a lovely idea. Thank you for your very easy surface engagement and for, you know, have you let the IDF know that empathy is the way? Like, please be in touch with them. I really appreciate it. So that piece actually came out of a chat with somebody whose name I don't even know. Some, okay, Hudson Valley soap maker, yoga teacher, God only knows. I'm sorry. See, that's my anger. deep breaths. It doesn't help to lash out, but there's just a lot of bullshit flying around.
Yes.
And shallow, just offensively surface.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. Empathy is a wonderful, wonderful thing, and I'm for it. But to sort of like toss that out, like, oh, do you feel better now? Cool. Anyway, we have some serious problems. Some of us aren't so lucky as to be sitting in our cozy little enclaves lecturing others about empathy. Like, some of us were ripped limb from limb, including people I know, relatives. Jewish community in the diaspora is not a huge, huge number of people, even though we seem to be everywhere, even though at the risk of inflaming anti-Semites, we do seem to dominate every industry, because we are awesome, but also complicated and human and fraught and not a monolith. And anyway, I'm sorry, I'm getting off topic.
No, it's fine. You're actually, I have a list of questions and you're hitting them in order, so I don't even have to talk. I was going to ask you, was there something specific that inspired you? And yes,
yeah, but you... So it was a little exchange, you know, and it was like, oh, yeah. You know, I tweaked it, and over the next few days, I've been in dialogue with so many friends and family members, and we're all so distraught and we're in so much pain. And a lot of that pain is compounded by how absolutely clueless and yet entitled to vehement opinion so many people in our secular circles, in our academic circles, in our creative circles, in our art and literature circles, in our social justice circles seem to be. So I was sending that piece out. I just cut and pasted it. And I was like, here, send this. And everybody was like, thank you, thank you, thank you. So finally I realized, you know, 24 hours later, I should just send this to this editor I know. And if she can use it, she's welcome to it. So I'm glad it got out.
Yeah, no, it's a great, like I said, it's a great piece. We'll link to it on the show notes. And I think what you're, you know, you were talking before about, you know, that you're not there on the front lines, but in a sense you are, because this is really an information war in a lot of ways. I mean, I think that's part of the issue that we're seeing now, is that by and large, Western, you know, democracies have not treated the information war as a real thing. And, you know, having a lot of, I'm by no means an expert, but I know now a little bit how to look for it and where it emanates from, and therefore how to sort of reconstruct it backwards to find out what's going on. There's so much misinformation, there's so much disinformation, and there's propaganda disguised as sort of humanitarianism, yeah, which is the thing that people like that, who are, I think, probably very well-meaning,
yeah,
and do have real empathy and feel for everybody, feel, yeah, you know, and it's tapping into that in the same way that, you know, the people in Ukraine who are like, we just need to have peace, man. We need peace. We need ceasefire. And it's like, yeah, if you do that, Putin wins. So no. But right. It sounds great because it's peace, but it's not.
It really does. I would love that. Let's have peace. Like that's what we want. Please.
Right. Yeah.
Would that it were.
Yeah. I mean, I've also seen people, you know, actively rooting for Hamas, which that's to me just completely batshit. I mean, you know, it's all there, but that's what I've seen. And I've seen also the kind of like weirdo right wing people that are always bad. Mm-hmm. Tweeting about free Palestine, free Palestine, free Palestine, 24/7. So whenever that group is on something, that really makes me, you know, give pause and say, okay, why are they doing this? What's going on here? This feels to me like part of a coordinated thing, and you know, with related to Ukraine in some way, given the bad guys, you know, being buddies and stuff like that. So, but are there any trends that you've seen in the information space that we should be aware of that are just, you're just like, what the, you know, what is this bullshit?
Yeah, it's what you say, you know, it's people who have a social justice bent and who are sort of like curious, but not that interested, not interested enough to really start to untangle or, you know, peel away the layers and layers of history and information and facts and on the other hands, and but interested enough or curious enough to say like, oh no, people are suffering. Like, I don't like that. Like, let's stop suffering. You know, so there's a real easy surface engagement that I think is obvious, and it's just it's everywhere, and it's and then I think there's a cognitive dissonance element too, of not being able to separate things out. You know, for example, Fox News right now, what I've seen is like they're right on about Israel. And it's disturbing when people or entities with whom you usually disagree, with whom you usually really, really disagree, are suddenly, I've seen that with a few different people. I mean, I could name names, but, you know, figures, public intellectuals with whom I usually agree. And it's like, no, you have this wrong, or you're not even entitled to have an opinion about this. Why are you talking about this? Or public intellectuals with whom I usually disagree being like, okay, well, thank you. But unfortunately, the message is tainted because it comes from somebody who's anti-queer, anti-abortion, anti, you know, so it's, I think that if, you know, this is what, I think we've all been talking about this for years, like at least since 45, the information war, you know, you've probably seen it inside out. That's the 45's ascendant election was directed that way. And I what I've heard for years, and now I see it in a personal way, not that 45 didn't offend me personally, but this is such a, you know, it could have been me, you know, I could have been in one of those videos. I could have been, you know, not that that's why we care about people, because they could have been us, but my point is that the lack of critical thinking, the inability to separate out, and the cognitive dissonance involved with saying, oh no, like Ta-Nehisi Coates, like you're awesome, like I totally agree with you, you're a good guy, so you must be right about this, or oh no, Ben Shapiro, like you're kind of a douche, I don't like what you have to say about most things, and I don't like your methodology in debate, but like, you're right about this. So like, shit, are we the bad guys? Like, it's so hard because we want to, I think it's human nature. We want to plug into something, have our questions answered, have the complexities smoothed out, and be able to move on with our day and not worry, not trouble ourselves any further. But we can't do that right now.
It's interesting that you bring that up, the flip, the topsy-turvy nature of this, because I remember that also after 9/11, it was just, you know, reading things like, oh, this guy who usually I hate, like even right now, Brett Stevens is like right on point. I'm like, well, oh my God, what a this broken clock kind of thing going on.
Broken clock. But thank you.
I think one of the issues is that, you know, this isn't a left versus right thing. It's so it it's complicated. There's no obvious, you know, with abortion, it's very obvious where our sympathies should be. With this, you know, it's up in the air a little bit. It's not as obvious to people. So because you have like the squad who are clearly, you know, you know, Rashid Tlaib tweeting out this river by the sea thing, river to the sea, you know.
Yamach Shemo, we say in Hebrew, may her name be erased.
Yamach. Yeah. But I want to talk about some of the, because again, one of the things that I like to do on this podcast in general is admit when I don't know stuff, because mm-hmm. I think it makes people say that it's okay that they don't know everything. And this is a situation where it's, you know, it's impossible to know everything. And if we don't ask questions and we don't get explanations for even basic things, you know, we're going to get confused and create more chaos when we shouldn't. So talk about that saying a little bit. Like, what is it? Where does it come from? What does it mean? And why is it offensive?
What? Which?
River to the sea.
Oh. From the river to the sea, I think the person you referenced, the congressperson whose name I hope is erased from history, she claimed it's an aspirational, it's a metaphorical idea. It's not. It has a very clear history, and the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea is all of Israel's territory. And when you say from the river to the sea, what you're saying, Palestine will be free, which is a lovely, lovely slogan because it rhymes, mm-hmm. it's cute, it has a nice like rhythm to it. I was very disturbed last week because I was watching so many videos and intaking so much that I actually got it stuck in my head.
Oh God.
Which is very weird and speaks to our moment in a way that I think is like, oops, I'm a Nazi. I'm just doing the dishes. Why am I chanting this? It means from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, that Israel will not exist anymore.
Yeah.
And that the millions of Israelis, many of whom are Jews, some of whom are Muslim, some of whom are Christians, some of whom are foreign nationals, some of, you know, it's a pluralistic democracy, the only of its kind in the Middle East, that it will no longer exist. And then the question becomes, where would you suggest all those people go? One of the most effective things I've seen in recent weeks is people using the Socratic method with protesters, with people chanting these things. Like, oh, so like, what do you mean by that? And like, just asking questions, not saying, hey, you're an idiot, or hey, you're an asshole, but like, oh, so like, what happens to the Jews then? Like, where do they go? Oh, like, who's governing that space then? Oh, it's Hamas. Oh, so they just let all the Jews leave then, even though remove all Jews from earth is in their charter? Like, what, you know, like, and when you push people a little bit, they're just kind of like, oh, I don't know, I guess. Yeah, sure, maybe. Oh, I never thought of that. You know. So from the river to the sea has a genocidal intent behind it. And I don't think most adorable progressive Brooklyn lefties know that, or maybe they don't want to, they don't mean it. You know, they don't really mean kill all the Jews. Well, they kind of just did that and like celebrated it, right? Like,
and their leader was on TV 2 days ago reiterating the policy.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, I'm not one to quote Oprah that often, but when people show you who they are, you should believe them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think what a lot of people don't know too about Gaza is that Israel unilaterally withdrew in 2005, helped run a fair election in which Hamas was elected, unfortunately, and was gone. And within literally 2 hours, found itself under rocket fire. So hence the blockade. I mean, it's like any measures that Israel has had to put in place to sort of like contain or wall off or, you know, blockade or have been in direct response to being attacked.
Yeah.
It's not some situation where it's like, let's oppress these people. We hate them. We, you know, a lot of the terrorists who were killed on the 7th by people trying to defend themselves were found to have work permits to work in Israel on them. Which is which is a hard pill to swallow. And at least one of the leaders of the massacre was in prison in Israel for years and was released with 1,000 other Israeli prisoners in exchange for Gilad Shalit in 2012. I mean, this is intractable. I mean, I find it adorable and enraging that there are people who seem to think that there's like an easy answer here.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's very, very complicated. And one of the things that makes it complicated is the Netanyahu aspect.
Yeah.
I mean, I've talked about him a lot on the podcast, on my live show. He's just a criminal. And he's the Trump of Israel and worse in some ways. Yeah.
Worse because he doesn't have a spray tan and he's not that stupid.
Yeah. Yeah. He's dangerous. And
he belongs in
prison. Right. And Israeli people didn't like him before this happened. All summer, there have been huge, huge protests.
All year. Huge. Yeah. I had plans to go Saturday night to protest in Tel Aviv with a friend. I was really looking forward to it. I was like going to write about it. I was, you know, and I'm sitting in a bomb shelter Saturday morning thinking, oh no, I hope the protest isn't canceled tonight. Like I just wasn't. The protest movement has been beautiful, enormous, and really getting somewhere, it seemed. Yeah. Really doing something.
And now, I mean, if we didn't like him before, we certainly don't like him now, because his primary responsibility, as I understand it, is to defend everybody. And he just fucked that up as royally as it can be fucked up. So
terrible.
Not only that, but I'm not qualified to speak about what they're doing in the war. And I have high estimation and opinion of the Israeli intelligence services generally. And I think that if they're listening to intelligence and trying to kill as few people as they can while rooting out Hamas, they're probably doing that. But optically, you know, since the hospital, which I think, you know, and all of that came out of the health ministry, which is run by Hamas, that changed public opinion very, very quickly.
I hope so.
I mean, but in the wrong way. I think that's the thing that.
You're saying you think, are you talking about the hospital that they claimed Israel bombed, but
yes, it
to be an errant missile from Hamas? And
yes,
it was, yeah.
Because initially when that happened, nobody knew anything. There was a guy on Twitter with a blue check that wound up being some rando who said it was this and that. And it was like the Winston Churchill line about, you know, the a lie is halfway around the world before the truth can put its pants on, or whatever the saying is. And putting that back in the bottle is hard. I think Biden tried to do that. So Bibi has all of this. There's also the point that worries me is that he's said basically, well, when the war is over, then that incentivizes him to extend the duration of the war. So I don't know. What's your take on him? Like, how are we supposed to think about this?
I hope him and Trump and that congressperson who's claiming from the river to the sea is some kind of metaphorical idea. I hope they all have a grand old time in hell together. It's Israel is a deeply imperfect democracy, like all democracies, and had a huge struggle ahead before October 7th. And now what I'm hearing and seeing is that people are hunkered down in solidarity together. Jews, Muslims, Israeli Arabs, Druze. I mean, it's like on the ground from what I hear. All the other issues have sort of paused. It's really about like, how are we going to get to the South and pick the crops that need to be picked so that they won't all go to waste? And how are we going to take care of, you know, hundreds of abandoned dogs? And how are we going to, and who's taking care, you know, and when are we going to get our hostages home, and who needs what? And there's hundreds of thousands of refugees within Israel from the South. Israel evacuated everyone from the South. The hotel that I was staying at in Tel Aviv emptied out of tourists almost immediately and filled up with refugee families. So there's, I mean, almost everybody in Israel is helping in some way. They're hosting. It's everybody has a kid who's been called up. Everybody knows somebody who was killed. It's a tiny country. I'm sorry, I didn't answer your question about Bibi.
No. And I'm glad you're talking about this because it helps make, you know, the situation on the ground there is obviously very important and not being reported on enough. We know what's going on in Gaza. We don't know what's going on in Israel as much. I mean, that's what I've seen anyway. Just the general, certainly on social media. So it's interesting to see how that is. But what it sounds like, at least, you know, it could be a unifying thing. In the way, again, 9/11 was a unifying thing that was.
Yeah, I mean, I hope the 9/11 parallel doesn't extend to sort of how nightmarish and protracted and shitty the military situation was thereafter, and how many. And I'm not qualified either to speak to the IDF situation and what they're doing, what their strategy is, but I do know that Hamas is not an army like we're used to the idea of an army. They wear civilian clothes and they embed themselves in civilian populations. They build tunnels. They've used billions and billions of dollars in aid, both from Israel and from the United States and from Qatar and from, you know, to build tunnels underneath. I mean, and to dismantle infrastructure, to build rockets and to hoard fuel. And, you know, it's like there's aerial photographs of here's 500,000 gallons of fuel that Hamas is stockpiling to fire rockets at Israel while they're claiming they need humanitarian aid because they're running out of fuel. It's a farce. This is not an enemy that is like straightforward. Maybe no enemy is ever trustworthy, but this is not a war that is going to look good for Israel on the surface, because what army in the history of the world has ever let the enemy know beforehand when and where and how they are going to strike? I mean, Israel is doing everything it can to minimize civilian casualties, but that's not how Hamas plays it. That's, you know, they've been preventing their own people from leaving. It's just so complicated, and my chest gets very tight.
I don't want your chest to get tight, but I'm grateful that we're talking this through. I want to stay on Hamas for a minute because I feel like it has to be re-said that they went and did this thing, this horrible, atrocious, I mean, barbaric, just horrible, you know, unspeakable thing. And there's no ever justification for what they did, no matter of anything. And they have pledged that they're going to keep doing these things.
Right.
Until, I guess, Israel doesn't exist anymore, which, spoiler alert, that's not going to happen. So, you know, that's what you're dealing with. It's like it's a horror movie villain. And until it is killed, it will keep trying to kill you. So, you know, they can't just sit down and do nothing. Right. There has to be some method of rooting these guys out. And maybe the intelligence services are good enough that they know who everybody is and they can get to them. You know, I don't know.
Well, there's this horrible idea, you know, this expression that's been applied to situations long before this, but this idea that like you cut off the head of the beast, but another head grows in its place. And, you know, the origins of Hamas, the oppression of Palestinian people, the conflict going back decades, the retaliation and the retaliation and the retaliation and the retaliation. You know, this is something that there was a beautiful piece in Jewish Telegraphic Agency ran it. I don't know if it ran anywhere else, by David Grossman, who's an Israeli novelist, wonderful novelist. His books have all been translated to English, a lot of them, many of them have at least. And I highly recommend his work. And he speaks very beautifully from an Israeli point of view about just the intractability of this, and that, you know, we have our work cut out for us now, but like, then what? And then what? And how are we ever going to get to a point where it's enough? It's done. You know, we can't. People calling for ceasefire, it's very quaint. It's lovely. It's like moon and meadow. Empathy, ceasefire. Like, thank you. That's great. I don't want to be raped to death. You know, I don't want my babies beheaded. I don't want my grandparents executed. I don't know what to tell you, but like, I can't like cease fire and like chill out and wait for that shit to keep happening. You know,
the only thing that will happen in a ceasefire, and this isn't just, this is Stephen Ross, the former ambassador who negotiated one of the original, you know, the Clinton era agreement that wound up not working with the Palestinians. Someone who knows what he's talking about wrote in the New York Times that the ceasefire can't work, because what will happen is Hamas will move everything around. They'll get more weapons in, and that's it. And the hostages are going to be there for longer, and it doesn't help Israel at all. It's not going to help the people of Gaza at all. It's only going to help Hamas. But again, it sounds nice.
It sounds great. Like, thanks, everyone. That's a lovely idea. Like, let's hope that can happen someday. We also have to talk about Iran. We have to talk about who's behind this. Yeah. You know, most Palestinian people want peace, I believe. Most Israelis want peace. Most of us would really like to work something out where we can prosper alongside each other. But there's larger forces at play here.
I think the leadership has to change. Certainly Hamas, you can't negotiate with Hamas. They're not going to do it. That's just never going to happen. It's a non-starter. And, you know, Bibi and the far right there, that's bad too. You have to, it has to be fresh faces, I think, on both sides, which is great for me to say here in upstate New York, but you know, how is that going to happen? I wondered since the thing happened, I was like, God, what are they going to do? What would I do? You know, if you have these hostages there and you have to defend and you're, you know, I don't know. I mean,
it's impossible.
Yeah.
I mean,
what do you do? Situation.
And in the meantime, being vilified in the court of public opinion and on social media and like losing the information war. And, you know, I don't know. I wish I had the answers, but I do know that like, as a Jew, we read this book over and over and over again, and there's like a lot of stories and history in this book, and there's a lot of really unlikely victories over some really ferocious, intractable enemies and people seeking our destruction. Like, this is not a new scenario for us. And I just have to do my part every day, I think, is where I land. You know, I can't put on a uniform. I'm not O type blood. I can't offer my body right now, but I can use words. And so
the words are important. The words are really, really important, because right now they're losing. Israel's losing the information war right now. They just are. And, you know, that has to change. That's the first thing that has to change. I mean, what do you think of the job Biden has done? Because I think he's been fantastic. I think that him going there and all that, I mean, you were there when he was there, right? So talk about that a little bit. What was that like?
You know, people were so happy. It was like, because they've been, it's how we feel after Trump, you know, when Biden came on the scene, it's just like, oh, thank God, like a grown up, a human being. And that's how I think it felt to Israelis, that it was just like, look, it's like a statesman showing up and shaking people's hands and embracing people and expressing empathy and expressing caution and expressing a grown up, not an angry, disenfranchised terrorist on either side, not a criminal, seeking to cover his own ass, no matter who pays the price. So I think he's done a great job, and I think Blinken's doing a great job. I don't, you know, what do I know about what goes on in rooms behind closed doors? But it at least on the surface, it seems like we have some adults at some important tables.
I think so too. I think that he influenced the space between the attack and to try to minimize the, you know, not to lash out quickly and in anger and stuff like that. And there's floating around. I think they're probably behind the scenes trying to get him to step down, Bibi. That there's something that came out of the White House where they sort of were talking about what was going to be next there. And I don't know. I feel like that's the direction. Meanwhile, Biden's getting the poll number. I don't like poll numbers, certainly a year before an election, but he's taken a beating now in the poll numbers because a lot of the kids, the young voters now have been, you know, I was a young voter once. I voted for Ralph Nader in 2000. I know how this shit works. You know,
yeah. That was my first election. I was so excited.
I lived in New York, but, you know, so it didn't matter as much. But like, you know, did you go to did you see him at MSG? It was really awesome.
No.
There's a lot of people, a lot of famous people at that thing, barely reported on. Yeah, it was interesting.
I like that guy. But yeah, we were in New York. Good. That's good.
Yeah. So, you know, and now the poll numbers are going down and it's the young people. And if the young people don't come back, that throws the whole thing into, you know, into turmoil a little bit. Because I think as long as Biden is alive and sentient, he's going to win, unless there's some sort of black swan event, of which this could potentially be something beyond his control. Like, it's ridiculous to me that people in the United States are complaining to Biden what Netanyahu's doing. Like, he's not the president of Israel. I don't know. It's strange.
It is. It's very strange. And I can't, I feel like I'm so arrested in this moment that I can't even worry about that election.
Yeah.
It seems very far away. I just, you know, so many things are going to happen between now and then.
And if you think about, you know, if you pull back and think about the strategy of this and who it helps and who it benefits, you talked about Iran, I talked about Putin because I can't stop talking about Putin, but you know, the Hamas leaders met with them, you know, this year, like recently. And this is helpful for both of those people. I mean, you have Israel was going to sign the agreement with Saudi Arabia. Now that helps Iran. Right.
Yeah. People, this is not a coincidence. The timing of this doesn't seem like a coincidence. It was right before that was going to happen.
That was clearly the trigger, I think. But it helps Putin because now everyone's paying attention to Israel and not so much in Ukraine. Poor Zelensky is running around terrified that everybody's going to stop giving money there. That is we have to win that or, you know, democracy is fucked, I think. That's super important. Now that's taken a back seat. And, if Biden's poll numbers are, I don't think this is a blip. I think he's going to be fine, just to be clear. But if that really does hit and we get, this is a look at all these things that have happened because of a terrorist attack. And it's like, when are we going to wake up and not give the terrorists what they want? I think that's one thing we can do is not give them what they want. That's helping defeat them on some level. I don't know.
It's strange to me that like we're on the brink of World War III, and again we have like the proposed annihilation of the Jews on the line here, which is what happened in the last World War as well. I mean, like this idea of like no Jews, no news is really interesting to me too, because there's a lot of shit going on in the world. There are populations being massacred. There's genocide happening in places that we don't think that much about. We're not that interested in, don't make it onto our protest signs and don't have like an Instagram heft behind them.
Yeah.
So I've been thinking a lot too, and, you know, probably because I'm a Jew and I care about being a Jew and I'm an identified, you know, living Jew, you know, what is it? What is it about us? Like, what is the deal? Why are we this important to people, you know, in a bad way, or in a good way? It's a big mystery. Last week, I was thinking a lot about how in Judaism, we don't proselytize. There's no proselytizing in Judaism.
Mm, yep.
It's not allowed. And I was thinking on one of my many dog walks last week, what is that why are we historically, like, just going way back, we're like, we don't want you, we're good, just leave us alone, you know? Is that why, like, are we resented on some deep unconscious level because we don't want anyone to join us? We're not trying to get you, we just want to like do our thing, leave us alone.
I think the proselytizers are also you know, the proselytizers are annoying. You know, I don't think that's what it is. I don't think anybody likes the knocks on the door and the, you know, come to Jesus stuff. So
I've been wondering though, you know, I mean, most prominent religions, I mean, we're an ethno religion. You don't have to, there's no prerequisite of a belief in anything you're a Jew, whether or not you believe in God. I've been hearing a lot of that lately from very secular assimilated Jews. Like, I'm not religious, or like, I'm an atheist. It's like, it doesn't matter. That's not what Judaism is. But I don't know. I've just been thinking a lot about that. It's there's something I'm just, you know, there's the political stuff is overwhelming, and it's fascinating and endless. But, you know, spiritually, this has just been a really, a dark and huge reckoning, and it's epigenetically triggering, and it's deep. It's there's a lot going on here, and I'll let you know if I ever figure it out.
It goes, but I mean, it is deep and long, and it harkens back to a lot of awful things, which, you know, on the topic of the differences between the major religions, until very recently, lending money at interest was considered usury, I can't say that word, and prohibited by the church. So anybody who was Christian at all anywhere was not allowed ever to do it.
Right.
But you needed the money to, so Jewish populations did that, not because for any other reason other than they were allowed to.
Right. And we weren't allowed to own land.
Yeah. So it's like, what else are you
going to do? Let's go.
And, you know, and then when the kings of these places owed too much money, that's when they were like, mm-hmm. Oh my God, you know, so it's all about that. It's all about these horrible kings being awful.
I mean, we're traditionally scapegoated in any civilization, any culture, any country. It's, you know, so there's just a lot going on here, and it's beyond the political, and it's beyond spiritual, and it's beyond historical. It's so deep, and that's where it gets overwhelming, and I feel like I have to put it down for a moment or two.
Yeah, you do. It's it'll still be there tomorrow, unfortunately.
Exactly. There's a line in the Talmud that is oft cited. It's a very useful idea, and it says, like, you are not responsible for fixing the world, but you are also not entitled to desist from trying.
I like that. That's good.
You have to show up and offer what you can, but you can't do it all, and you're not going to do it all, and it's not your job, and it's impossible for any one of us, you know?
Yeah. I like that. That's a good way of looking at it. It's very wise. So let's end. Yeah. There should be a holy book around that.
Yeah.
So it's good. Let's end with this question, because I think this is also important. Like, there's a spike in anti-Semitic attacks right now all over in the United States, which is fucking, I can't, you know, it's boggling my mind, frankly. I thought we were past this, and I guess, you know, we're clearly not. If we want to be allies and help, we non-Jew, what can we do? Is there anything that we can do that would be helpful? What's the way that we can help the most?
I think that's a beautiful question. And I think that question itself is very helpful. Asking that question is a huge step and appreciated. You know, people who want to go a real extra mile, I've heard about some Gentiles putting mezuzahs up on their doors to make Jews feel safer. And I've heard of some Jews taking down their mezuzahs right now. I think there's an organization, there's many good organizations, and I don't know, I can send you some I like a lot. You could link to them. There's one called Memri, M-E-M-R-I. And their whole mission, all they do is translate media from Arabic so that we can see, for example, Al Jazeera will use the same graphic for a piece, but the English publication is very different from the Arabic publication. The English publication might be like friendly and, you know, sort of middle of the road and no big, and then the Arabic version could be very propaganda, inflammatory. And so all this organization does is translate Arabic media to show what propaganda is being used and how it's being used, and so we can sort of try to understand a little bit more what we're not seeing. and how this is happening, you know, how people get radicalized, how people, yeah. you know, start to think that jihadist terror is a cool liberatory thing, how people can demonize each other in these ways. And there are a lot of, I'll send you some links. There's some great organizations supporting people on the ground, Palestinians and Israelis on the ground, Israeli Arabs, people working together who want peace, who want to coexist, who want to cooperate and collaborate and not align themselves anywhere near the extremists and in their respective cultures.
Thank you. Where can people find you? You said you're on Instagram.
I'm on Instagram. I'm on anywhere books are sold. I mean, if you like novels, and novels, I'm having a hard time focusing on novels right now, but yeah, I'm around.
Yeah. We like novels on this podcast. We like novels and novelists on this podcast. We don't get to talk to them as often as we would like, but,
it's good. I'm glad I got caught in a war zone. It's nice to see you.
That's what it, whatever it takes, you know, whatever it takes. So, is there anything else you'd like to add as a closing thought before we close today?
I'm sure I'll think of it as soon as we sign off, but for now.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming on. I know this is, like I said at the beginning, this is hard to talk about. I know it's, you know, you were there. It brings up a lot of stuff, I'm sure. And I appreciate you coming on and helping, you know, teaching me what's going on. And teaching the listeners too. So thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Okay. Lisa Albert, thanks so much.
The Prevail theme song is by Matthew Fassa. Serena Zabriskie, Marie Cast, and Martha Acuna provided the introduction in Ukrainian, French, and Spanish, respectively. Voice talent is by Stephanie St. John and me. Thanks to Allison Gill, Molly Hawkey, and I Williams, Kimberly Johnson, and everyone else at MSW Media. If you'd like to support this program, get three friends to subscribe. The more downloads I get, the better the show does. You can also subscribe to The 5-8, the live YouTube show I do with my friend Stephanie Koff, aka LB. Tune in tonight for your Friday night hang. Most importantly, please subscribe to The Prevail Substack with updates every Tuesday, Friday, and Sunday. Your $6 monthly or $55 yearly subscription funds my work on the column and the podcast. Visit gregoliar.com to learn more. Thanks for listening. Drive safely. Be kind to each other. Try and enjoy yourself. And until next time, we shall prevail.
MSW Media.
I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.